So we'll just do a bit of talking.
So you're glad you retired?
Yes, I am, actually. In terms of being able to do other things. Mm. And if your father's got Alzheimer's, you just never know what might happen to yourself, so you want to get active.
Yeah.
You need to talk
with them. Yep. Well, yes, we've... Well, I'm going to retire at the end after the next state election, so I'm looking forward to that, I think. Want to find a good, do you want me to move?
Can you move a little bit closer?
Yeah, sure.
There we go.
And do you need a cushion or anything in that chair?
No, I think I'll be fine. Sure.
Got to get comfortable at our age.
That's right. Okay, I'm with Trish Coucher. It's the 26th of May.
Sorry day.
Pardon?
It's Sorry Day today.
Sorry Day, yes. I didn't know that.
National Apology, yes.
Okay. Oh, yes, 20 years ago across
Harbour
Bridge. We're here to talk about her life with the Greens. So, Trish, thanks very much for talking to me this morning.
Pleasure.
We want to start off a little bit, talk a bit about your early life and where you were born.
I was born in Adelaide in 1955 and just hung out in Adelaide till I was 16.
And did you have any siblings?
Two younger siblings,
And your mum and dad, how did they then move to Perth, or did you...
Well, my father was a journalist and came over to Perth as a news editor here for the ABC. So there was always an interest in current affairs and journalism in our house. We were probably the very few people that listened to the ABC all the time and only.
I think my family did as well. That and the morning paper were all about the current affair. And what year did they come over here?
They must have come over in 78, 79.
By that time, had you started university?
No, I didn't go to university until I was in my 40s. Right. I did have a diploma in home economics and did a bit of travelling. And then I came to Perth in about 78, 79, following my parents. Mm. Basically for a holiday, but I never left.
For the sunshine?
Well, my parents, everyone was here. My brothers had come over and then I came for a holiday and then I'd never left because I just got a life here. Mm. Yeah.
So all your early memories of Adelaide, really, growing up?
Yeah, I mean, I love going back to Adelaide. I think it's the most maligned city and it's great to go back. But, you know, I've got my life here in Perth now.
Can you remember the name of your primary school?
Clapham Primary School.
Clapham?
Yes, Clapham Primary School and Dawes Road High School I went to. And then when I left Adelaide, I went to Melbourne in 1972 to go to Emily McPherson College, which is now part of the RMIT, to study food and food science and nutrition.
Well, that would have been a very exciting move.
Well, I was only 16, so moving home at 16 was fun, interesting.
And you had friends you stayed with? And
I lived with my nana and then I made friends. Yeah. And some of the friends I'm still friendly with, so that's good.
That's fantastic how you retain those bonds from those early years.
Mm.
In terms of your early childhood and going to primary school and high school in Adelaide, was there anything, any experiences you had that might have indicated you had an interest in the environment and saving the world?
Not really. I mean, I think I used to notice what a lot of things were unfair. That's not fair, you know, that kind of thing. But it wasn't really encouraged at home. My father was a journalist that was of the old school where, you know, you have both sides, you argue both sides, you don't take sides, that kind of thing. So if I said something, they would kind of have the opposite view. But I always felt that. And obviously an interest in current affairs in the family. There was no strong sort of social justice in our family.
Right.
Yeah.
Just discussing the different sides of issues.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, my mum worked for a state government minister and my dad was a journalist. So there was always, like, they knew what was going on through the Don Dunstan times and all that. So it was quite interesting and they were kind of very involved in all of that.
And I'd imagine they'd probably talk a lot over the dinner table about their own events that day. If you've got
yes,
a father,
yeah,
journalist.
The politics and who's, yeah, you know, what the ministers were doing, and obviously shared stuff that maybe, you know, was interesting.
Let's try and move that. All right, there we go. And do you think some of your values were then formed by those discussions with your parents?
Look, I think the interest was. Mm. I mean, my parents were conservative, you know, pretty conservative. They were conservative voters pretty much to the end. So, it's really the interest, but not any, they didn't really have any passion. I mean, I think they were living it. I mean, they had three kids, they had to work hard. You know, they didn't have another life to do the kind of things that, that we did. You know, that it was very unusual times because my mum put her kids in childcare back in the 50s and 60s, which a lot of people did, and went back to work. So, I mean, she would have been doing the housework, doing the working, looking after the kids. My dad was quite good too, but quite a different, unusual life. I mean, I was, you know, one of the very few kids that went to after school care as a kid, you know, even in high school, after school.
Well, it is very unusual because many women in those days would have had to give up their jobs when they got married and had a family.
Yes, so she did give, well, she did give her job, but went back when my youngest brother was, I think, two or three. Yeah, and she really wanted to, and it was a bit unusual.
The minister she worked for then, that would have been a Liberal minister, was it?
Liberal, and yes, Liberal in the state government, yeah.
And 72, moving to Melbourne, that's the beginning of the Labor federal government. Must have been exciting.
Well, it was exciting. It was exciting. I wasn't particularly politicised, but that was exciting being in Melbourne. There were sort of protests you could see and that kind of stuff.
The anti-Vietnam.
Well, yes, moratorium. Yes, there were the moratorium things. And then when I went back to Adelaide after my course, I finished up working as a cook for Sir Mark Oliphant when he was the Governor of South Australia. And by that stage, he had kind of become more of a peace person instead of a person who invented the nuclear bomb. And that was quite interesting. He was a vegetarian and I'm a vegetarian, so they were very lovely people. And that was quite interesting. And some interesting people came to Government House in South Australia. And I remember when Sir John Kerr came to Parliament House after the dismissal. And interesting that some people found out which entrance he was going to go to so they could protest his arrival.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Yeah. And in terms of those times and working for the governor, did you feel, what were your own political thoughts at that stage? Can you feel something developing, or you're still just...
Oh, look, it was a social justice and it was, I mean, and, you know, my final year when I was studying in Melbourne was the first year you could get the what's called TEAS, the tertiary education. So that did change a lot of things. You know, I could move into a flat, whereas I was living with my grandmother, and then I was living as a nanny for my free rent to... because I didn't really have an income. So the third year did change things for students. Yeah. And, you know, you could tell that that was in the air. That must have been in 74, I think, when it came in.
When you then moved to Perth in 79, you're coming over once again when there's a Conservative Liberal government in WA. Did your mum, was your mum working still in
My mum became a legal secretary, so she was more doing that kind of work. My dad was a journalist.
For what paper was he?
He was for the ABC.
ABC?
Yeah, he was a news editor.
How did you feel coming to Perth with, you know, I suppose it was the Charlie Court government then? Or
look, I was just like excited about, you know, something new, and I was 20, 21. Yeah. And I was doing a lot of meditation then, and I trained as a teacher of transcendental meditation. So I kind of was a bit more of an inward, you know, I wasn't so attached to what was going on, more through sort of world peace through inner peace sort of philosophy, and travelled overseas to train as a teacher. So I was kind of away quite a bit, and then just coming back to my parents' place.
Okay. With the meditation and the vegetarianism, was that something you sort of decided yourself, or you stayed with a friend who was in that area and you wanted to choose what they were doing as well?
No, I think I just, it was interesting. When I was 20, I realised that there was kind of more to life than the common experience, as they say. And I wanted to find out kind of what that was, and wanted to make sure that I went on a trajectory. Because, you know, when you're young, you can go on a particular trajectory with alcohol and what have you. And I decided I wanted to try if there was some other way of living that was, I mean, I don't know if I articulated it so much then, but I think, and it was a bit of a turning point because, you know, I stopped drinking and, just had a different kind of more contemplative and meditative life, but not reclusive. I mean, completely out in the world, but
And you've maintained those values.
Absolutely, yep. Meditating twice a day since 1975.
Fantastic. Made you very calm. Thoughtful. Come on, you go.
That's for others to judge.
In 79, that wouldn't have been very common, was it, to be a vegetarian?
No, it wasn't common at all to be a vegetarian. No, it was very unusual.
And not drinking alcohol.
Yeah, and when I went to live in Kalgoorlie, being a vegetarian person, not drinking and not having a television, I was very in the minority.
And what made you go to Kalgoorlie?
Well, I went there to teach home economics, and I went there in 1980. My brother died, and I was only 25, and it created just a whole upheaval in the whole family. And I just went up there for 3 years and taught school and lived up there and did something a little bit different.
Keep that. At what stage did you get interested in the anti-nuclear movement?
Well, probably up there a little bit because. Well, you know, there was a lot of mining going on up there, and there was a couple of people, Andrew Coburn and Sharma Peebles, Andrew Coburn, brother of Jeremy Coburn, the UK Labour leader, ex-Labour leader, and they were doing a lot of stuff up there. I mean, you'd go to a meeting, there'd be three people there, and they were pretty... I mean, I was on the edge for Kalgoorlie standards, but they were really, you know, in the margins. But, I mean, I was interested in that there. And then when I came back, and there was all the kind of Russia, you know, the Cold War stuff. And so when I came back in 1983, I got involved in People for Nuclear Disarmament straight after that. So I think got very interested in it up in Kalgoorlie, yeah.
Well, did you feel much resistance or even retaliation in Kalgoorlie from having those views, whether they're your lifestyle views or your political views?
Not really. I mean... Not, I mean, I taught at a school. It was a Catholic school. It was fairly conservative. I mean, you can just hang out with the people in Kalgoorlie. There aren't that many of them, but, you know, you hang out with people and that are reasonably like-minded. Yeah.
Coming back and joining P&D, that would have been when they were still at the Environment Centre in Wellington Street?
Yes. Yes, I think so, yeah. I joined the Western Suburbs People for Nuclear Disarmament because back in the day, P&D had... a lot of regional groups or local groups. And so you could go to a Western Suburbs P&D meeting, there'd be 20 people there, 25, like it was amazing. Yeah.
Had you heard about P&D while you were in Kalgoorlie? Is that how you...
Well, I think through Andrew and Sharma Peebles, yeah, I'd sort of heard about them. I think they were the Goldfields P&D group. So when I came back, you know, I don't know how I heard about them, but I finished up going to the Western Suburbs meetings.
Joining P&D, was that in terms of wanting to work on issues around nuclear weapons and, as you're saying, the Cold War?
Well, I think it was the weapons and the fear of, you know, well, nuclear disarmament, fear of nuclear war.
Rather than nuclear power, you know, the proposal to build a nuclear reactor.
Well, look, I think, I mean, that had kind of happened before, you know, I'd come back. But, I mean, when understanding the whole fuel cycle and the Australian connection as well. But I think it was the weapons and the threat and all that kind of stuff.
Being a member of the Western Suburbs P&D, was that where you met Jo Valentine and...
Well, she wasn't in that group, but that's when I met that group of people. But really, it segued very quickly into the 1984 federal election. And that's when, you know, P&D, while it was a community organisation, the aims of the Nuclear Disarmament Party were exactly the same. And so it was easy for those people to kind of get behind that. And in a way, it didn't feel like you were in a party political situation. You were just using this election campaign to push your message out. I mean, obviously that changed as Joe got elected and then became a political party. But really, it just felt like this is just another excuse to talk about this issue and get a platform.
I interviewed Annabelle and she mentioned her statement at the time of 84 that they'd done too well and got Joe elected.
Yes.
So you weren't expecting her to be elected?
Well, no, I don't think we were. Though the buzz was incredible and the ease of engaging people in the issue, because we'd had a lot of Palm Sunday rallies. And so there were those bunches of people out there. And, I mean, when I look back, I don't know how we got so many people to those rallies because we didn't have the internet. We didn't have mobile phones. We didn't have any money. But somehow we used to leaflet everybody's letterboxes and they must have read them and come along. So there was a network of people that actually cared about that issue. And so somehow they did absorb that message when we got out, you know, when Joe spoke.
Was there much of a difference doing your work as PND coordinator to then working for Joe in the campaign in terms of your...
Well, I wasn't the PND coordinator there. I was working as a teacher and I was just a member of the Western Suburbs group.
Right.
And then Annabelle and the campaign said, why don't you organise an event and invite candidates and get the media, because we couldn't get media and they'd never done one of those events and I'd never done one of those events. So I said, okay. And so we got, you know, Peter Cook and a few other, you know, Liberal, I can't remember who they were, and Joe and somebody else. And then we got some media, someone from the West, and they had a panel. And we did it at the Social Science Lecture Theatre and it was full.
At UWA.
At UWA. Right. And that was the first one of those events. I'd never done it. Obviously, I didn't do it on my own, but I rang up and organised the people and all of that. So it was a pretty exciting event and it really did put that on the agenda and the media were there. So, because it was the only way to get the message out in those days.
Yeah.
So that I was doing that as a volunteer through the Western Suburbs PND. And then at the end of 1980, well, Joe got elected. And so I worked on the campaign just in my spare time. I wasn't pivotal, but, you know, I was involved in it. Then after the election, I resigned from my job. And then the following year, I became the coordinator of People for Nuclear Disarmament.
Right.
And started five. Yeah, and organised the 85 rally and all those kind of things.
The 85 Palm Sunday rally.
Yes, yeah. And by then, Joe was in, but she hadn't taken up her seat because she didn't take it up till.
It's a bit of a lag.
Yeah.
Harking back to your organising for the Palm Sunday rallies and this meeting at UWA, you're talking about not having the internet and emails and so on. What were your main organising mechanisms to get people to attend meetings like
well,
that?
Well, I mean, we had phone trees and they were pretty effective of people ringing one person who then rang two people, who, you know, and then those two people rang two people and those two, and by the time, you know, by the end of the day or the next day, a lot of people had been rung.
Had they got the same message though at the end of the phone?
You know, we had leaflets and we had structures and people didn't, like, if you said in 4 weeks at 2 o'clock there will be this event, it would be on. It wouldn't, like in these days, it's like people text and say, oh, we're not going to do that now or we're going to do it later. Like everything was a bit like we would make a plan, we would tell people and everybody would work towards that because they know that that would happen. Now I know with organising it's a bit like, oh, let's do something, you know, on Saturday afternoon. We'll send an email out. But you couldn't do that. Like you'd have to have a mail going out for a particular event. People actually read their mail, you know, or you might leaflet an area. So those kind of stuff was actually the way that you communicated and people invited friends. And then you had networks like, you know, parents with kids who were interested and the doctors were interested and, you know, those special interest groups would tell people. And I think there was an urgency at the time that people were willing to take action. And the other thing is that we did have US warships coming into Fremantle where you could actually see the cruise missiles from the main street of Fremantle. So it was pretty sobering. You know, it was sobering for people that were awake and knew what was going on.
And you were involved with those protests?
Those protests, yeah. That was part of the work of PND.
Yeah.
But, you know, the word just got out and everybody came.
The women, I would imagine, at the Western Suburbs PND and the supporters there and around Joe, did you find they held similar values in terms of, you know, your vegetarianism, your meditation, your spiritual approach?
Look, I don't think so. I don't think it's something we talked about. The people that you became like more friendly with, maybe.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the values and it was the community values that people had.
Mm.
You know, the community values of working together you know, for a common goal.
Mm.
And, you know, some of them you still see around, you're friends with them and you've got this very much a shared history.
Mm.
Maybe it's not so much a personal history, but you're always interested in what's going on in their lives.
Mm. You mentioned teaching at a Catholic school in Kalgoorlie. Has religion been a big part of your life? Or your
not at all. No, no. I mean, well, I grew up with, you know, my I grew up, my grandmother was a Jehovah's Witness, so I was one of the original door knockers when I was five.
That's where you learnt your skills.
Yeah, when I was five, I was one of the original door knockers. But no, not really. I used to go to church. My parents didn't, but not really an influence. And then once I started, I just went to a Catholic school because I got the job.
Mm. At what stage did you join Joe's team?
Probably in later in 1985, and I was there. I was there probably till 1988, about May 88.
How did you find the difference of having worked at P&D on a campaign, organising events on a particular focus like nuclear arms race, warships, to then being in Parliament and focusing on legislation and government actions and so on?
Look, when Jo was in, she didn't have the balance of power, and we used the office as an activist thing as well. And that the project that I worked on was Letters for, what was it called? Something about Letters for Peace. I'll have to look it up. And so what we used to do is we used to lobby for peace. So it was really just an extension of the lobbying work that the community does. So some people manage Parliament and Joe in Parliament and that kind of stuff. But, you know, she went to Pine Gap and did all the activist stuff. And I managed a thing called Lobby for Peace where we would mail out to everybody every 6 weeks a lobby leaflet. This is the information about Pine Gap. Write to this person, this person, this person. Here's a draft letter. Write a letter or ring their office. And then people would do that, and then I would ring them and say, how did they go? How did you go? And we would encourage this community of lobbying. Should I put him up?
No, I think he's okay.
No, he's just being random barking. Yeah, so that was kind of, it was a community engagement thing using the resources of a politician's party. Can I stop it for
a minute? No. Okay. You want to put him out?
I might put him out.
Okay, we'll start again. In your lobbying campaign at Joe's, you said it went hand in hand with other staff doing the sort of parliamentary legislative work.
Yeah.
It sounds like you would have needed a pretty close-knit group of people to break up that work and keep Joe advised of what was going on and so on.
Look, yes, we did, but, you know, in a way, she was a lone voice.
Mm.
It's not like now where you've got, say, the Greens have got a party and then there's all these independents and then there's all these other randoms and they can do stuff. It was, like, very difficult for Joe to actually have a win. We could put up motions and we could do stuff and everyone would vote against us and then we'd tell the media, oh, Liberal and Labor are voting against us. Who knew? So it didn't have to be so strategic. She could go on some committee things, but it was using the resources to go and talk. So Joe would go and travel and talk to people and inspire people. So it was a lot of community activism using the resources of that office, and holding ministers to account. And because Joe was so kind of, she didn't mind, you know, going into a press conference and questioning the Prime Minister or embarrassing people or standing in front of a warship. So it was community activism
in Parliament
and using those resources, which the movement never had, So.
Well, that's obviously also probably why she was so attractive in terms of the Nuclear Disarmament Party, trying to have her as part of that.
Yes.
Did you join the NDP? Or did you just...
Well, when the NDP was here, yes, we did.
But did you actually have to join the party as such?
I think I would have been a member then.
Yeah,
I'm assuming I was. No. I can't remember, but I'm assuming I was. I can't remember about the membership.
And did you get involved in the negotiations around the NDP and whether to stay in or not? And
well, yes, because there were those bunch of people were involved in that. But, I mean, at the end of the day, Jo kind of had to make the call for herself because she was the one that was exposed to, you know, the stuff that was going on.
You said you left Joe's office in 1988. In that 3-year period, what do you think was the greatest highlight in terms of a new part of your life working in the Parliament?
Look, it was incredibly exciting with great opportunities and having resources to do the activism that was important, like the rallies, like the warship stuff, like she went to Pine Gap, you know, and having a platform to say this stuff. And I mean, I'm not a frontline person, never wanted to be a candidate, but being able to work behind the scenes to make it happen for somebody to say this stuff was very important. to me personally.
Did you ever go to Canberra with her?
Oh, yes, we went to Canberra, yes. Yeah. Yeah. But that was really just to kind of make lobbying connections and to help out, and get research done and, yeah.
In terms of you leaving Joe's office in 88, what was the reason behind that?
I got pregnant and had a family, and I just decided to take a break from that then. I had a daughter, Lucy.
Yes.
Who I'm now very pleased to say works in a similar role that I do for Senator Rachel Seward. So that's pretty exciting because we're kind of colleagues now. Yeah.
How did your family feel? Because I would imagine you would have continued your activist work or interest in politics while you're having a family. How did they feel about your involvement and your intense involvement in those issues?
Well, I mean, at home, you mean?
Yes.
Well, look, it just carried on. My partner, Robert, was very involved in all of it, incredibly supportive, and we all went to rallies and did stuff together. And, I mean, that's how we met, because when I got arrested on a warship, Robert was the person giving free legal advice.
Very handy.
And so that's how we met. So, you know, and he's, he was back involved in Kane back in the day before I was involved. So, you know, look, we carried on as a family doing activism stuff. And then, you know, the kids went their own ways and did their own things. And Lucy's now, a communications advisor and very involved in the party. Yes. So that's kind of quite exciting.
And at what stage did you then go back into employment?
I worked for Oxfam in 1994 as a community campaigner. And I also did a degree in politics and women's studies over that time. And
was that at
Murdoch?
Murdoch.
And I also got involved in the Sorry Day Committee here and organised all the original events with after being requested by Sir Ron Wilson. He rang me up one day and said, would I organise the first Sorry Day thing in Perth? And I just said, oh, yeah, because you can't say no to Sir Ron Wilson.
And Sir Ron Wilson is?
Well, he did the inquiry into the Stolen Generations, and he was a High Court judge that retired and did that inquiry, and everybody was following that. It was harrowing about the Stolen Generation, and one of the recommendations was that a Sorry Day being held, and among all the, there's a lot of recommendations, it's probably the only one that's ever really been done in a national apology. And so I got involved in that. And again, that was like starting an event from nothing. I wasn't working. I'd left Oxfam by then to finish my degree. So like from my home without the internet.
There must have been the internet by 94. Come on.
Not at home.
Right. Not at home. Yeah. Yeah.
No, the first, yeah. When was the first Sorry Day? I'm not sure when. Anyway, there was no internet at home.
Yep.
There was a fax, if you were lucky.
Yeah.
And there was no mobile phone. So just that. So I did get involved in that. So that's kind of what I did. And then in 2001, I went to work for Giz Watson, who was the member for North Metropolitan for the Greens.
Mm-hmm. In the West Australian Parliament.
Yes, and I was there for 7 years working half-time as her electorate officer. And she, the Greens had the balance of power for part of that time. And that was a very exciting time in politics because it gave the party a lot more resources.
Well, very exciting because I think you had five members there.
Five members, yeah. Large, and that was really an exciting time and interesting because, you know, people say, well, the Greens getting them into, and it will all be ruined. And actually, it happened. We had shared balance of power, which we've done in the federal. And, life goes on and just good things happen. And Giz was an exceptionally good member of parliament in that she really understood legislation. She really understood committees. She really understood how to get things done. Often stuff that a little bit goes under the radar because you make a consensus decision make with people from differing views and it goes forward as an idea, that's a success. But if you start talking about it, then everyone backs off from the other side. So she was very good at that consensus across parties and was quite inspiring because she would be a person that'd say, I will talk to anybody, any issue, I will talk about it. I will talk to people about it because we've got to pull it all together. Yeah.
In that term, 2001 to 2005, with five members,
yeah.
out of the six regions. Did those members operate more as a party, you know, normal Labor, Liberal, you caucus together, you had a whip, you had a leader?
Look, they did. Yes, they did. And it was probably the most cohesive, you know, because, and they had a lot of staff, you know.
How many staff?
Well, I mean, when I first went to GIZ's, we had 1.2 full-time equivalent staff, which is not very much. And then the government changed and allowed people to have 2 staff members per MP, which is still not very much. But then they did give the Greens an extra staff member for the 5 of them to help with Parliament. Mm-hmm. So we were pretty busy with constituent work and preparing for Parliament and supporting, you know, our MPs. But they did work together and the staff tried to work together as well.
That's what I was wondering.
Yes. Yeah. And the portfolio, you know, 5 of them, you didn't have to have so many portfolios, even though, you know, you could have, you know, between 5 and 10 portfolios, which is a lot of work to cover. So you had to really pick your battles because you not only had the portfolios, but you had your region. So, you know, North Metro, something happened in your region and constituents contacted you, you would have to assist that as well.
Did Giz have an electoral office in the region?
She had an electoral office in Leaderville.
In Leaderville.
Yeah.
And did you work from there?
She worked from there. Mm. And in even now, there was no staff in Parliament House because there was no room for them. So Giz would go off and do her Parliament thing almost unaided. Mm. Which doesn't happen so much these days. She was very self-sufficient, but there was no office there for staff. Mm. And, you know, there was nothing.
Yeah.
There was barely a computer there. Mm. Yeah.
So your staff, or her staff, such as yourself, were in Leaderville in the office.
Yes, yeah.
The other 4 members would have had offices in other regional parts of areas, WA. Yeah. How did you then liaise with their staff in terms of working together?
Just mainly on the phone. We would have meetings every now and again, and help each other and, you know, refer people and that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Along the way, working with the Greens from 2001, when did you join the Greens as a member?
Look, I was a member at the original Greens on the 1st of January 1990, of which Lucy was at that meeting.
Right.
And now she's but she was only a baby. Mm. So I joined the Greens then, and I was quite active in that time. And then I kind of had a bit of a hiatus and left the activism. I think somebody told me that they saw in the minutes that I resigned from the Greens, but I don't even remember why.
Okay.
And that, you know, rather than let it lapse, I resigned. So something must have irritated me, but I cannot remember what that was, or I've maybe irritated a lot of people.
And you rejoined in?
Well, I rejoined when I went back to GIZ.
To 2001.
Yeah, yeah.
And in that time when you were a member and you're at home with Lucy, did you go to meetings of your local group and...
Not so much, but I mean, I worked on the election in 1984, 1987 and 1993. For Joe's election campaign.
As a volunteer.
Yeah. So basically, I went in. Mm. So in 87, I worked on, then 1993, I worked on it as well. I must have had two children then. Must have been another one in there.
1990, there was the one that Joe won as a Green.
1990, I did that one. And that was the one where I don't know what happened to Lucy during that. She was very young. But yeah, so I would go into and for that time work on the election campaign, which is in a way, back in those days, it's what you did. Like the election came, like you didn't know when it was coming, you got prepared. And then there's like the 6 weeks and everybody drops everything.
Yep.
There's not, you know, there's a little bit of planning beforehand and setting up. But really, you know, we came in and I worked on those elections.
What sort of tasks would you do during that 6 weeks to help in the campaign?
Look, there were lots of different tasks. I mean, some of it, one campaign... It was getting booth materials out, you know, that kind of stuff. Another time, I think I was doing a lot of work on ringing groups up and, you know, can you do this? Can you do that? There's this event or whatever. Encouraging people to do local events. I mean, we did a lot of stalls and that kind of stuff. Mm. Yeah.
In 2001, when you joined GIZ's office, what type of tasks were you doing in your half day a week?
No, it was 2.5 days a week, half-time.
Half-time.
Look, I was in her electorate officer, so I would deal with constituents, I would deal with letter writing, do a little bit of research, manage her diary, and that kind of stuff. Mm. I mean, it would vary. You know, when Parliament was sitting, you'd be help write questions. Mm. She had a research officer doing some of the parliamentary stuff, but, like, I would write questions. Mm. Some of them, you know, particularly if it's a local constituent, you know, area matter, I could get the info and write the questions up and submit them, that kind of stuff.
And did you help draft speeches and so on for her?
Not so much. Giz was pretty self-sufficient with that. And also she did have someone working 2 days a week and then 5 days a week on research officer. And they did a lot of that stuff. But Giz was very self-sufficient.
So your skills, from what I hear, were that you developed at PND, then in Joe Val's office. You'd use those skills at Oxfam or Community Aid Abroad, as it probably was then. And then during your election. But in your Giz's office, it would have been a different sort of skill set you were using, was it, in terms of dealing with the constituents?
Well, dealing with people and trying to figure out, a lot of it is trying to figure out, well, how can you solve this problem or how can you make it important? Mm. And so sometimes someone's story could turn into an issue that you could talk about publicly or even make a change. So it's that balance between trying to solve people's problems, but then using that information to change things more systemically.
Yeah.
Because we can't, you know, the elected office jobs are difficult and interesting because we're not social workers, we're not lawyers, you know, we can't take on everybody's issues because we don't have the resources and we're not. But if we can help a few people and that informs us to make systemic changes, writing to the minister, did you know this goes on? Here's an example. Here's a case study. That's, I think, the skill of those jobs.
At that time, what was your... Were you in the Fremantle Regional Group, were you?
Look, I guess so, but I didn't really attend regional meetings. Okay. I'm a bit more of a events and election person.
Right.
I love a good election. So, I mean, in that time, you know, there were some state election campaigns that, you know, I worked on. But, you know, basically, when the election campaign was on, I just kind of kept the electorate office going and did a little bit of stuff. The party was doing the election campaign. But then I have got involved in subsequently some election campaigns after when I was working with Giz and from then on. So I think I've done about 11 in total.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So you were saying you didn't really get involved with going to reps, say with Giz any of the working groups?
No, not really, no.
Yeah. And after your time with Giz, she got re-elected in 2008.
Yep.
But you decided to move on from her?
Well, what happened was that in 2007, the federal election came up and I was asked to take leave and work as the campaign coordinator for the 2007 election when Scott was the candidate. And so I took 6 weeks leave without pay, and that was in, I think, November, December. That all wrapped then. And then I went back to Giz's office because Scott didn't take his position till the 1st of July in 2008.
Right.
And then after I had that, I was like, oh, federal politics, that's very exciting. Yeah. And so I told Giz and I applied for a job with Scott. And so I stayed with Giz until the end of June, and then I went to work for Scott in federal parliament.
As a full-time job or a part-time?
4 days a week.
4 days a week. Yeah. Oh, fantastic.
And so that was very difficult to leave Giz because, you know, she was a great person. But it just... And when I left Joe's back in the day, I thought, I'm going to come and do this again one day, you know, because I was giving up in Giz. I didn't know what was going to happen. But, you know, I decided that this is something I'd like to do. And so I did. Yeah, and so I went to Scott.
Which is a very different role because he's representing the whole state.
Yes.
Whereas Giz is one region. Yeah. How did that impact on your work and the things you were required to do?
Well, look, we did have more resources. So that was really good. I mean, 4 staff, and we could, you know, because I was only 4 days a week, we could employ more people. And then there was a bigger party room federally. Mm. So we had more resources and the leader's office had more staff and we had the internet and all that stuff. So things were very, very different. And in a way, I mean, we had WA, but really it was the portfolios we were mainly interested in. I mean, you know, and then Scott was very strong on the nukes, the uranium mining, that was his thing, and the IT and the internet and security and global security and privacy. They were his really big things. And he also had housing at some stage. So they were really, the housing stuff was more and homelessness. That was very much in your face, in your electorate, where people are at, because
But some of that you would have known about through your electoral work with GIZ.
With GIZ, yes. And so there were federal policies and state stuff, and then there was like finding homeless people houses and that kind of stuff.
I've been interested in looking at the MPs as they've been elected. Did Scott get much help from state MPs who'd been in Parliament about what to expect, having been to be a parliamentarian, be a new person?
Look, I think he had mentors from Joe Valentine and Giz. You know, I think he used mentoring a lot.
Yeah.
And I mean, he was considered quite young then, and I mean, he was very. I mean, I went to Scott's Meet the Candidates when he was standing, and I didn't know Scott then, and I came away and said to Giz, what is this person? What's wrong with him? He doesn't talk. He's very quiet. I felt like I should ring him and say, Scott. Anyway, something about him got him pre-selected. It certainly wasn't his public speaking. And I think that was also his charm, that he was very quietly spoken and people had to listen to him. And he did command that attention and certainly grew into the job. And being young, I mean, that whole thing about being young and never, no one's taught you how to do it, you make it up. Yeah. And so you can be a bit kind of out there. And even when he finished and he was in his 40s, people still thought he was, you know, a young senator.
Yeah.
And I used to laugh and think, wow.
Because Giz faced the same situation in 2001, being new to Parliament.
Yeah.
Obviously, there'd been a few other MPs before that. Oh, 96, sorry, she got elected.
Yes.
Didn't she, though?
Yeah.
But Jim Scott had been the first MP. Yes. Then Giz comes in with Chrissy, so they're brand new to Parliament. Yeah. And trying, one, to work together, but also work out what it is to be an MP.
Well, and what and how do you want to achieve it? Because there's a lot of busy work that you can do, but how do you kind of not rise above that, but try and figure out how you can make an impact and change while still helping people?
Yeah.
It's quite a challenge.
Did you find that the office that Scott put together worked differently to that Giz put together?
Not really, because you still had the roles. Like, you still wanted to do the community outreach, you still had to deal with the constituents, you still had to make Parliament work. But because you're in the federal Parliament, you really have to pay attention because of the, you know, we were moving into the internet and more of a 24-hour news cycle, and if you do something really dumb, everyone's going to notice. But there were particular roles, you know, and someone had to do the research, and, you know, when you gave a speech, there was more people watching that.
Yeah.
And you had to bring people along with you. So in a way, it's the same. There's the same elements of people. And then there's the party stuff. You have to make sure the party's happy with you and, you know, the work that, you know, because you're seen a leader in the party as well as in the community.
Yeah. With Scott's nomination, how many people had nominated for that Senate position?
Quite a few, maybe eight.
Eight, wow. And you heard them all at Meet the Nominee?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
I can't even remember if I voted for him. I can't remember. Right, yeah.
I'm sure there's a record.
Well, no, it was a secret-y thing.
Yeah.
In
terms of that work, because the other thing about a senator is all that travel back to Canberra. Yeah. Did you do much of that travel with him, or you?
It wasn't my key role. Yeah. I do that more now, but it wasn't my key role. I was more like the office manager, the chief of staff. Sometimes we have people based in Canberra, so we didn't have to do so much travelling. Scott did a lot of travelling. He was away a lot, and I didn't go so much because by the time we got into the Senate, it was very difficult to, if you were over here, to think, oh, I'm in the Senate and this is what this means and this is what a notice means and this is what, like there were so many levers in there that it's really an art to know what they are. You can't just kind of go in and be much of help. You're really just an extra pair of hands unless that's your role, and then you really know the parliamentary process back to front. And we did have the opportunity to use more levers because there were more people, so... it was a bit more of an art.
Yeah.
And
you already had that experience with Joe in the Senate.
It was a long time ago, yeah.
So things were a bit different?
We'd gone from the old Parliament House to the new Parliament House.
Okay.
So that was fun. I didn't have such a parliamentary role.
And in terms of 2008 and Scott coming in, that's, you know, the same time when the GFC hit, there would have been all sorts of policy issues he maybe had to think about. Yeah. Was there anything there you noticed a bit different, just the pressure of Greens having to come up with a
look,
new...
Look, I think there was all of that going on, but we did stick fairly, not strictly to our portfolio. So it was easy for him to talk about, you know, defence and peace and non-violence and nuclear, you know, and the waste of money and all of that in a portfolio, in that context, you know. So we talked about those things through the lens of our portfolio. And, you know, you could save the world's problem by not spending so much money on armaments and war. Mm. It's not a complicated message, but, it's you not. Know.
No one picks it up, though,
it's
Trish.
Been going on for, you know forever thus.
And as a senator, did Scott travel within WA much to other regions?
He did. Between him and Rachel, you know, they did, you know, do things, taking turns, you know, up north and what have you. But a lot of it was him going to speaking things, national speaking tours and that kind of stuff. Mm. You know, around an election campaign, we would go and talk to people and stuff like that.
So by 2008, obviously, the media have had a Greens senator for quite a number of years.
Yep.
Did you see that they responded differently to Scott as a senator then than you did with Joe back in...
Oh, very much so. Mm. But, you know, in WA, media in WA for the Greens is never easy. Mm. You know, I mean, in the 2007 campaign, I remember that the West didn't cover us at all until about a week before, and someone rang up and said, you know, we're standing, and they put in a story. So, you know, we would do all these events, these media events, we'd do stunts, we'd put out press releases, you know, and in WA you could not get covered. You know, you might be able to get on ABC, and if you got on any of the others or the West, it would be in criticism. So... But nationally, there was much more interest in the Greens than in Scott. And then once we could make our own media through the internet and had more of a digital-first focus, it was much easier to reach our people that are sympathetic because, you know, whether the West covers it or not, as we know, you know, particularly now, hardly, you know, anyone reads the West. More people read a post on Facebook than read the West.
Yeah. And Scott had a... predilection for doing good social media.
Social media was his thing, and digital first, and talking to the people that are persuadable, that are interested and engaged.
So you had to learn some new skills in that?
I did, yes. Yeah? It was a challenge.
No more telephone trees?
Yes, it was a challenge. Yeah. But, you know, it is interesting because I feel like we have done full circle a lot in terms of, you know, the internet came, people started getting emails, it was all very exciting, and then people... I think stopped reading their emails, and then we had to, who knew, ring them up, talk to people, and we started to do a lot more talking to people, and that's when we started doing door knocking in the Greens and campaigning, and having smaller meetings and kitchen table meetings, and I think that's been really interesting because that's I think in the way the world's turned. And not that we don't do digital stuff because it is a great, we can broadcast our own message, but the one-on-one stuff with door knocking, you know, when you look at the stats around election time, if you door knock in an area, your vote will go up because people will talk to you. Now, with COVID-19, we've kind of gone now back to the internet, but in a different way through Zooming and meetings and breakout groups and stuff. So it's been quite interesting, that whole communication thing. But I personally think that we use the internet and then it kind of people and emails and then people stop responding. Mm. And now we're forced to be more communicative with people and talk to them.
And you're with Scott up until the whole issue around his ability to stand as a senator.
Yes, so he resigned on the 14th of July 2017. And his office stayed open for a few months after that until the High Court did its thing. Though he'd resigned, the High Court had to make a decision because his office still stayed open and we were office without a senator, actually.
But still dealing with electoral matters.
With electoral matters and referring them on. Okay. And we had to do portfolio stuff for other MPs who'd taken up his portfolio.
And then after that, after...
Well, after that, when Jordan Steele-John got pre-selected by the party to take over that casual Senate vacancy, I moved to Jordan Steele-John's office as his chief of staff, and I'm there still.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Have you noticed much difference in terms of, obviously they're very different personalities, Joe, Scott, Jordan. Has that affected the environment you're working in their office, their approach and their personality?
Look, I think the personalities are different, and I think, I mean, I think personally, I have worked for, and I'm not just saying this, but four of the most outstanding members of parliament because of their incredible vision and integrity and the way to connect with people and their authenticity. So, you know, obviously moving from, you know, Joe, those people, and then moving to Jordan, who was 22 or 23 at the time, a very young senator who had been a student, never had a paid job. He became a senator, like incredibly different and interesting. And in the beginning, you know, we set up a structure that would support that. And I mean, it doesn't matter who you work for. The elements of an elected office are the same. You know, you need the constituents, you need to be able to talk to ministers' offices, you need to be able to do parliament, you need to grow your people, you need to solve problems. All of those things stay the same. Different portfolio, different lens. And, you know, obviously somebody who is very young has an incredible vitality and, you know, unguarded and not uncooked, but not in a bad way. Like, nobody's told them you can't do this. And so, and a youth, they can do stuff. And it's inspiring. As somebody older, think, oh, okay, it didn't work before, but let's do it and see what happens. And the reception has been very different too, of somebody, everyone was watching, and someone with a lived experience of disability. It's been very difficult for the media to be mean.
Okay.
I mean, they can be mean about some things, but it's been quite difficult for them to be mean, I mean, about him or, yeah, and that's why I got away with a lot of stuff, you know, with the Royal Commission into abuse and neglect of disabled people. Like, he's telling the stories from lived experience. It was very difficult for people to say, well, you don't know what you're talking about. You know, they're just calling for another Royal Commission. And then when he, you know, did all that lobbying and took a bunch of disabled people to Parliament and then went into the House of Reps and that kind of stuff. Like, I think if another member of Parliament or Senator did that, you know, about nuclear issues or about homelessness, so all those things that are, or aged care, all of those things, you know, if Rachel had gone and done that about aged care, not quite the same. So he did get that honeymoon and that latitude, and now I think has got respect because he does have that very good experience. So that's been exciting. It's been like, let's do something new and different.
You talked about going back to the future with phone banking and the door knocking. It's a little bit different, isn't it? Because back in the 80s, you were talking to people, door knocking, phoning people about possibility of nuclear war, the end of the planet.
Yeah.
Whereas now it's more, I suppose, about in terms of ensuring that you get somebody elected to Parliament, the Greens' policies get raised in Parliament. How do you feel that difference between a movement that you work for and now a political party?
You see, the message is just as terrible because it's climate change. And whether you talk about climate change through the lens of, you know, young people's future being impacted, I mean, to me, it's the same. Like, we're talking about the end of the world with nuclear, which is still there, just saying, but now it's the climate thing. So when we do a lot of door knocking, while you might be talking about some of the more local issues, but if someone says, you know, I'm really worried about my kids and getting a job, it's like, yeah, we are too. And we want renewables. You know, we want to be able to action on climate change and give our kids a future. Or I'm worried about housing, or I can't pay my heating bills. We want a future. So I see them, I mean, I'm not door knocking or doing this to get a green person elected. I'm doing it to change public policy. And when we talk about people, like obviously around election time, the message is to vote. But the work we do in between is building that movement so people care and understand about climate change. And I see them as being as urgent now as the nuclear stuff that we worked on in the past was. And, you know, the doomsday clock is very close.
And there's still a lot of nuclear weapons.
There are a lot of nuclear weapons and a lot of waste and a lot of, devastation in communities around the world. So I see them, it's just kind of the same story. Yeah. I mean, you know, talking 30 years ago, people's future, young people's future was impacted by the by weapons and war and all that kind of stuff and famine and all of that.
Have you maintained your resistance to get involved in administrative roles in the party?
Look, I am involved in more administrative roles. So I was the so I've been involved in quite a lot of elections, 11 elections, and I became the co-convener of the election campaign committee. So in 2013, I did that, and I worked on this. I was a co-convener for, I think, the state election in 2013, the federal election in 2013, Scott's by-election in 2014, the 2016 election. There was also a Canning by-election in 2015. And another by-election in 2018 and a state election in 2017. So I was a co-convener of the election campaign committee for about 5 years until people realised that we probably should not have one person doing the job. And so now it is rotated a bit more. So I was the election campaign co-convener and I have... In my roles, I've done tried to do a lot of mentoring and getting people in and, you know, for example, Tim Clifford was a co-convener with me and now is a member of parliament and other people have done that. So I had that role. I am now on the administration working group for the party and I'm also the convener of the candidate assessment team. So doing those, I have been doing those jobs. I was made a life member of the Greens a couple of years ago. And I think when they do that to someone, they put a terrible responsibility because you feel like you have to do these things more than, I mean, I was obviously going to do that. Just like, oh, well, I better do that. So that kind of administrative stuff. I mean, sometimes I feel on an admin working group arguing about a particular policy or discussing, I think, I just want to save the world, you know, one policy at a time. So I try to keep that balance between the administration, which I know is really important to grow the movement, and talking to people and doing that stuff. And I see them both, you know, important and hand in hand. But I also see my role as mentoring younger people, and I do that through my staff. So, I mean, I'm, you know, by 30 years, the oldest of the staff in Jordan's office. And I will be retiring at some stage, but in the meantime, I'm certainly mentoring the staff to take on roles and training them up and doing that with young people because I feel like that's a really important role. And then I think, well, I don't mind taking on those administrative roles more because I'm not a frontline person anyway. You know, I'm not thinking, well, I can then go and, you know, get elected or go on council or whatever. It's more like I want to create a very strong, firm foundation so you people can go out and do that amazing stuff and, you know, you will have somebody behind you.
One of the core values of the Greens since 1990 has been decision-making by consensus, which was probably something that the anti-nuclear movement did as well. How have you found that in terms of being in a senator's office and having to make decisions? Are you comfortable still with...
Look, I mean, probably one of the reasons that I left the Greens in the middle bit was because I think that consensus decision making can be very liberating or it can be used for ill. So, you know, you might have an illusion that, oh, we've got consensus decision making and you've got a group of three people in a shared household making a decision, taking it to reps and saying, this group thinks this, when you know it's just two or three people. And so... I think in the past, while, you know, I think it is the only way forward, if you don't use it properly, it can be manipulated. Whereas now I think the party uses it. Everyone's been trained up. We don't have small regional groups of three people living in a shared house making a decision and then putting it forward as if, you know, they had more people behind them. So I totally support how we operate. Sometimes I don't have the patience for it. But I don't have to go to those meetings if I don't want to. In a senator's office, we it's a bit different because you have to, you know, we make collective decisions. But at the end of the day, it's your senator who who's taking responsibility, and the buck stops with them in terms of their accountability to the government, to the money they spend, to, you know, how they travel, all that kind of stuff. So they have to make a decision with the best advice. And you have to respect that. You're only an advisor. You give your advice. They make the decision. So consensus decision-making works in terms of discussing it. But if push comes to shove, that happens. And I think you have to respect that. And the party has to respect that as well, in that, you know, they're members of the party, but at some times, if they're in parliament or the party thinks they should do something, but it's not legal or not illegal, but it's not possible, there's a little bit of a tension. And, you know, you've got the Greens WA, you've got the Australian Greens, we've got our senators are members of the Greens WA, but they're Australian Greens senators in Australian Greens party room made up of people from different member bodies who have different rules and different levels of who they're answerable to. So I think we make a very good job of a very complicated system of governance and consensus decision making, and, you know.
When you joined the Greens back in 1990, January 1990, the constitution then included the EC, the campaign committee, the reps, consensus, the four pillars, and so on, and it remains today. So it's quite a stable structure over 30 years.
It is. And I think, you know, you can thank a lot of people that stuck with it. You know, Gears is someone that's very committed, and other people in that process. And I think we have stuck to our principles really well. And if at any time it's kind of gone a bit skew-whiff, it's recalibrated incredibly well. And, you know, the numbers and the members have gone up and down and up and down. But I think we've always, like, you've always got your membership, but there's so many supporters that wish the Greens well and will come and do election campaigns. And I think a lot of the stuff we're doing now is about movement growing. Like, we want people to become members. But, I mean, I'm a member of other organisations, but I don't go to their meetings. I don't participate very much. I send them some money. I read their emails, and I might go to a dinner or something. And some people are in the Greens like that. You know, they pay their money, they love it, they'll come and hand votes. But we have got enough people, core people, that like to do the business of running the party. But long as we have those supporters and the people that share our values and come out for us and will speak up for us and talk to their friends, that's a success. You know, I don't think we need 10,000 members in the Greens. We need tens of thousands of people supporting our values and getting us elected and understanding that we don't want to get elected for the sake of getting elected. That doesn't interest me. It's for the difference we make. And we can only make the difference if we get elected and there's a lot of people behind us. Because you could get elected, and if they're not there, you don't get the public. You know, like, Jordan wouldn't have got the Royal Commission just by being a senator, a Green senator. It was only that he was there and there were so many people behind him. And that's the model that I think is at the Greens is very good at.
In terms of being part of the Australian Greens, did you have any involvement in the discussions about Greens WA joining the Australian Greens?
Look, I was around on the periphery to some of those discussions, and I know that we were reluctant to do it because WA is different, as we know. And, you know, I think it's really good because it was a very considered thing that we did. And I think that as that terrible saying that we do punch above our weight, you know, we've had more senators, you know, our staff, people from the Greens WA and Greens members staffers have gone over east a lot to help. You know, we're considered quite highly in the movement because of the way we've operated, the consensus decision making. You know, we've got a long history. Not that, you know, Tasmania does as well, but I think, you know, we consider stuff and work through those things. So yeah, we were a bit slow to join, and it's not without its issues, but I think it's kind of interesting.
Did you support?
Look, I think I probably, yes, I think I did. Yes, I would have supported because I knew that we have to be, you know, particularly from WA, it's so isolated. You have to be part of the big thing. But, you know, we do have a lot of autonomy. Yeah.
Your movement history and then joining the Greens Party has seen a lot of changes, especially in terms of the number of MPs,
yep.
up and down, sometimes yep. none. Now yep. we've got six
yep.
in 2020. What do you think the future holds for Greens WA in terms of growing the party and also parliamentary representation?
Look, I think we never take any election for granted, and it is so nerve-wracking because the influences that come out from the outside, you know, like in the last election, and then Scott Morrison won, and we're thinking, we thought we had communicated climate change and people cared about that, and the climate strike and all of that, and you're thinking, so how did that happen when you're thinking a particular thing? And I don't think it's blame ourselves. So the external is so unknown, but we are incredibly steady, and like we've gone from, you know, 0 to 5 to 10 to back, you know, it doesn't stop us. You know, you have an election, you don't do well, you know, people get about a week off. It's like, I guess you can sulk for a week, you know, and then you've got to get back to it, you know. And so after the last election, like after, like, okay, what are we going to do? We can't give up. We can't give up on climate change and the next generation. So how are we going to reinvent ourselves? And I think the Greens will always, always do that. And the problem is the forces that are against us through the media, through the mainstream media, and money in politics. You know, if you got money out of politics, if mining companies and banks and all those other people stop giving money to the major parties, then we would have a completely different scenario. And if that happened, I think, you know, we'd be ruling the world. Until that happens, I think we will go up and down, we'll continue going up, but I don't think we will ever, ever go away.
Yeah.
And I think the time has shown that, you know, when we were down and we didn't have a senator, you know, we went down to two MPs and then we've gone up and what have you. And it's like, and that's what I encourage young people to do. It's like, this is your life's work. It's like, there's no point thinking, oh, the next election's, you know, next year, and then I'll go up. Like, it's like, it's your life work, and it's not just the election. It's all of the things. And they also encourage people to have a life so that you don't give up everything and then look back after 20 years and say, I gave up everything, and nobody cares. It's like, you have a life, you have your kids or whatever, you have your holidays, you have your family, you have your relationships, you don't forget your parents, and you do this work. And then you can do it for 20 or 30 years because it's a lifetime work, because the forces of darkness are not going to go away, you know, and we know that because they're still making weapons and we have Trump and we have all those other bad things.
You've had an extraordinary commitment, really, to the Greens in the last 30 years. Is there any personal achievements over that time that you're really proud of?
Look, I think I'm proud of that I've kept it going, that it's a long-term thing, you know, from and through Oxfam and all the, I'm very committed to the work of Oxfam and poverty and on the ground, because I think it's good to have that balance between this is a policy in Parliament, this, but then there are actually people on the ground that you can help change policies to assist. So I'm proud of doing both of those things. I think I've kept my commitment and my integrity, and I think passing it on to other people, the next generation, and seeing them blossom, seeing my daughter work in that space, is really a good thing. You know, every time you have an election and you win, you're really proud. But even if you lose, you're really proud because you did a good job. I mean, I loved working for, you know, I mean, Scott winning the by-election was good after that kind of funny nonsense when we actually lost 2013 election. I mean, that we forget that, you know, and by the time, and with by-election we won. But then by 2016, it was like, we actually lost the last general election. Let's not pretend. And we worked very hard on that 2013 election. It was devastating. And it was great to get Scott back. Losing Scott again was a devastating a devastating thing. And while I wasn't involved in the first time he filled out his election, his nomination forms, I was involved in the others. So I was part of that believing Trish. Scott. So, you know, interesting times, and they still let me work on the cave. Yeah, they still let me help people. So yeah. I wasn't the only one. But, yeah, I mean, there was a bunch of people that were kind of very naive. But, I mean, I think if we look back, we would find that most people have been in Parliament. We're not eligible to either in the past.
Right. And all the procedures now are very strict.
Very strict. Very formal. Very strict. Mm. Yeah, very strict now, yes. That was a very hard lesson for everybody. Very hard lesson.
We've covered a lot of ground over your 30 years. Is there anything I haven't asked you about or you'd like to add in terms of those 30 years and working for the MPs?
Look, I think it's a privilege. It's a total privilege to be in. To have paid work of doing what you feel passionate about. It's a total privilege and incredibly lucky, and being able to do it through COVID-19 and through the ebbs and flows of the party, it's a privilege. And then the volunteer roles as well, and I know that I will continue doing those when I finish in my paid role. But I mean, I don't think I could have been luckier to be able to do all of the things I've done, including having, you know, two children and, you know, a relationship and all of the things and doing this work, you know. I mean, I think being able to work and follow your passion is what makes life meaningful, and I have been lucky to be able to do that. So that's all I can say.
We've been very lucky to have you for the last few years. Thanks very much, Trish.
Thank you.